Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 215, Ostriches Trump Elephants. But that was in 1860. This southern land swept by thunderstorms that appear as if by magic to lash the landscape and then rumble across the stubby felt, slinging lightning like a million-volt silver shambok, shaking rocks with the deep growls, bringing everything back to life. The air before these denizens of the blue sky pass is sullen, the horizon hazed over. After the rains, everything is crisp. Visibility can change in seconds, from only a few hundred meters to a few hundred kilometers. I was raised in Inkwaleni Valley in northern Zululand, where the mysterious Mhlathuzi River flows powerfully after these storms. The valley is ringed by mountains that rise from 650 feet above sea level to over 3,000 feet in a few minutes of a drive up around Malmoth. And from these heights, you can see the Indian Ocean more than 40 kilometers away, but only after one of these refreshing storms. Southern Africa had been drying out substantially throughout the first half of the 19th century. Historian Charles Ballard notes that climatic research points to opposite extremes of weather patterns in the northern and the southern hemispheres. The climatic region in southern Africa of dry and warm conditions in the early 19th century was the reverse of the northern hemisphere's colder and wetter weather at this time. Some animals, like humans, would not survive this. Others, like the ostrich, were in their element. More about that two-legged flightless bird in a few minutes. Stephen Nicholson's construction of climatic chronologies for 10 regions of southern Africa, published a few years ago, point to a continual decline in rainfall and progressive desiccation of lakes, rivers and springs from about 1800 to 1830, and numerous droughts in the 1820s and the 1830s. We've heard about the effect of all of these in the last few dozen episodes. When the climate changes, people change. Animals move away. Everyone grapples with survival more profoundly. And if they're able, they migrate rapidly from ancestral land, leaving gaps geographically, which remain etched in their descendants' minds. The oral stories about these lost lands are melancholy reflection exaggerated the further away they migrate. Chronologies for the northeastern, northwestern, and central Cape Colony, the south and southeastern Botswana, and Natal suggest that these regions suffered from severe and frequent droughts during the early decades of the 19th century. The late 18th century descriptions of the Beer Vlei near Willowmore in the Northern Cape portrayed it as an area of bushy grasses, swamps, springs, periodical rivers. But by the 1820s, Beer Vlei was being written off as completely dry, barren, desolate. Historians debate the full effects of these drying periods on human history. However, we have some pointers about just how crucial rainmakers and traditional leaders were and are in this whole equation. When your worldview is predicated upon calling down a reasonable rain, Western-trained academics are hard-pressed to ignore the obvious importance. I mean, tree rings don't lie, and they point directly to a significant drying in southern Africa in the first half of the 19th century. Water is life. This debate partly stems from the Imfecane, or the Difukane, the upheaval and movement of the people that some attribute to the rise only of the AmaZulu Empire. Others point to a mix of causes, climate change, resource pressures, even slavery. Some go further, blaming the entire capitalist system for the weather, a kind of grand conspiracy that stripped black South Africans of their land eventually. Treading carefully through this intellectual minefield, let's burrow into what was going on climate-wise and in other areas in the period after 1850, just before the discovery of diamonds in Kimberley. The role the drought has played in the history of southeastern Africa cannot be downplayed because of its implications for one of South Africa's most ideologically loaded questions. Who were the first legitimate and rightful occupants of each of these parcels of land? As you've heard, the first legitimate occupants were the first peoples, the pastoralists, the Khoi, and before them, the San, and before them, the ancient humans, Homo sapiens, who lived on our landscape up to 200,000 years ago. Droughts caused our ancestors much pain and suffering, long before Europeans rocked up. Turning to Natal, much of the interior was unstable. Drought and famine led early white settlers to believe it had always been devoid of people, whereas it had been abandoned. There is a difference between the two concepts. Never settled or previously settled. Nguni-speaking refugees, not always AmaZulu, arrived back in their homes in Natal through this period, only to find that the settler community considered them to be aliens, a race of vagabonds. It became a conventional ideological tool for those who sought to justify the expropriation of land. The people were driven away by a long list of threats, and then military, environmental, and meteorological issues. But that preamble, let's focus initially on the strange saga of John Donne, who has appeared in all his curious glory in previous episodes. If you remember, he had fled from Zululand at the Battle of Ndunukusuka, where Cetshwayo Kampande defeated his rival brother Mbuyazi Kampande in 1856. John Donne had recrossed the Jugela in 1857 to meet Cetshwayo and demanded that the Zulu chief and heir to the throne return 1,000 head of cattle he'd taken from two English traders at the time of the battle. Cetshwayo was impressed. Donne had intimate knowledge of Zulu traditions and customs, and showed due respect, so he returned the cattle. But the Zulu chief went further. This was before King Impande Sa Zangzangakona died, but he was losing power day to day. Cetshwayo was regarded by many Zulu as the king in all but name. It was normal for senior chiefs to allocate lands and gifts of cattle to subordinates, and so Cetshwayo gave John Donne 10 oxen and a large tract of land. By July, the former border agent had resigned his job and moved into Zululand permanently. He'd had it with the British. He was another of those settlers who'd been ripped off by what he called the Roman Dutch system. If you recall, he'd worked for a local merchant in Durban who'd hired him for a trip inland, but upon his return, the merchant refused to pay the young John Donne, saying he was under the age of 18. Donne was already far happier living amongst the Zulu when the Natal Traders Association blamed the confiscation of cattle on his presence in Mbuyazi's camp before the Battle of Ndunukusuka. Lieutenant Governor Scott and the diplomatic agent to the natives, Theophilus Shepston, saw fit to issue a harsh censure to Walmsley, another border agent, as well as Donne, for both becoming involved in the Zulu Civil War without the executive government's sanction. Having been treated thus, Donne took off for the delights of Zululand. The tract of land given to him was extensive in the immediate coastal region of southern Zululand known as Nguye, which extended from Nguye Forest all the way down to the lower Tugela River. Shortly after he moved in, Donne took many wives. By 1860, he was regarded as one of the most influential chiefs in the Zulu kingdom, ruling over more than 50 square kilometers of land and thousands of subjects. By the time Donne died of natural causes in 1895, he had 49 wives and at least 115 children. He was wealthy. He paid Lobola between 9 and 15 head of cattle for each of 46 of his wives. The other three were gifts, including two women from Cetshwayo's own Isigodlo in appreciation for Donne's gifts. And what would these gifts be, you ask? Firearms and ammunition. By 1860, Donne was the main source of firearms entering Zululand, and these items rapidly replaced cattle as the main payment for Lobola. When the first trades began around this time, one musket was worth 10 cattle. John Donne built an empire within an empire. He is thought to have married into 23 different Nguni clans, the majority from the southern and central coastal regions of Zululand. He took 5 wives from the Mzimela clan, 4 each from the Dube and Zuza, 3 from the Mtetwa, Shandu and Mtletshe. He also married women from the Nguni people living near Lake St. Lucia. Other multiple wives were from the Dube, the Langeni, Magubani, Kanyile, Kumalo, related to Mzilikazi, by the way, the Mpanza, the Ndlovu, Mbokasi, Sokulu, Mbambo, Nkanyana, Nkwabeni, and Ngenge. Donne understood the advantages that accrued to polygamous marriages in Zulu society. the extension of kinship, the control over clients, loyalty in exchange for lobola, a reciprocal dependency. By the time we get to the mid-1870s, we would have heard about how Dunn was central in the trade of goods up and down the coast from Durban to Delagoa Bay. But this episode is not just about people. It's more about what was going on when it came to the animals. The way in which game had been treated in South Africa was going to turn from bushmeat to commodification. Good grief. Who comes up with these words? Commodification. Well, in a few words, commodification is the process of turning something that was not traditionally bought or sold into marketable products or services. Wild game in South Africa after 1850 turned from merely being hunted on the hoof out there on the veld, beasts like elephants and rhino being shot down for ivory and horns, or buck and crocodiles for hides, or lions for their skins, to a system of mass production of game farming. These days, we take our thousands of game farms for granted. But imagine back in the day, these animals were just wandering around the usual hundreds of thousands of years old haunts, doing their usual felt things like prey versus predator. Some animals were being hunted to the edge of extinction already. They were being flattened in the Free State and in Natal. Expeditions had wiped out entire herds of elephants. There were none left in Natal by the 1890s. The history of wild animals in South Africa has been written from the elite archives of imperial hunters or storytelling around trek boer and African campfires. Wild animals were turning from res nullius, Latin for a thing which has no owner, to public property or res communis, also known as res publica. Res nullius, or unowned wild animals, belonged to no one until captured, free-ranging until shot or claimed. Res communes, on the other hand, are creatures that by their nature are a shared resource, like fishes or migratory birds. Res publica are resources for the common good. So wild animals were being transferred from being part of a market system into state custodianship by the end of the 19th century. It was in the Cape that this process had been differentiated from the rest of Southern Africa by a permissive legislative tradition. The effect was to reduce the reach of the central state, i.e. Cape Town, and registered a broad range of matters with the local, rural or divisional and urban and magisterial state. It's interesting to note that at the start, game was only a number of fluid social categories of wild animals in the Cape, alongside domesticated and vermin animals. Private game reserves or places to hunt proliferated in the Cape, where there were no public reserves. These places were private property, an enclosure at the behest of rural gentry, and most of these in turn would be swallowed up by farming. Let's consider the ostrich, hunted freely and openly on the scrubby flatlands of the Karoo, the Little Karoo, the Cape. They were only fully domesticated in the 1880s. Before this, they could be found scattered around the countryside, flashing their portable dust-fighting feathers, their hefty protein-rich eggs, a source of many a giant scramble on a dusty trekker morning. By 1860, the growing middle class in the Cape was becoming more vocal about their rights to access hunting areas. Game preservation became a rallying cry of the English-speaking urban elite, but they were kept out of easy access to hunting areas by Dutch landowners. The more these would-be urban weekend warriors demanded a right to access wild animals, the more the Dutch owners distrusted the state and defended their paternalist prerogatives to wild animals against encroachment. Adding a little layer of interesting complexity, the English-speaking rural class of the Cape were totally in agreement with their Dutch rural neighbours. The proponents of public ownership in the Cape were the urban middle class designated the title sportsmen. By the mid-1860s, these sportsmen tried to forge an alliance with English-speaking landowners eager to save wild ostriches for domestication, but Dutch farmers battered away these first attempts. There was an insatiable appetite in local and international markets for a wide range of animal products. It was also about protecting livestock. After all, the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, had put a price on predators' heads and even banned the shooting of other game, ensuring that lions, wild dogs, hyenas, leopards, jackals, so on, would be exterminated in the Cape. All this did was force the other trade underground, and an illicit market existed from the earliest days of the frontier. As this frontier moved away from Cape Town, The trade took on the character of a kind of secret gold rush of its own. Ivory, for example, was making quite a few people very rich indeed. The British tried to impose hunting licenses on all citizens when they took over the Cape in the early 1800s, but had to drop the idea in the face of strong opposition. By 1823, this changed, with new game laws defending select wild animals in an arc of territory around Cape Town between Hunklip and the Berg River mouth. Outside of what was thought of this charmed circle, wild animal hunting was in all respects unregulated. I mean, who was going to enforce that ban? Farmers were allowed to shoot any game they liked for travelling consumption, i.e. biltong, or to protect their fields. They were in charge of their farmland and could grant permission for others to hunt on their property. By 1860, the British began to reconsider all of these freedoms. The countryside was filling up with farmers and immigrants. The pressure on land was growing. A state tax on hunting was instituted, but throughout the rest of the 19th century, it was almost completely ignored outside the ports and their immediate hinterlands. A similar process was underway in all colonies, in all new lands, such as America and Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Across the globe, wild animals were seen as the staple of frontier commerce and transfrontier hunting, and were an engine of colonial expansion. The key commercial species in southern Africa were elephant and ostrich, the elephant for ivory, ostrich for feathers. Elephants were supposedly royal game. None could be shot without the governor's permission. So this really meant that elephant hunting was a transfrontier enterprise, as expeditions funded by private individuals headed off into dangerous territory to hunt hundreds of elephants. These trips required substantial investment, many wagons, lots of ammunition, guns, dozens of labourers, drivers, oxen. Ivory is heavy, it was high bulk, but its availability inland meant that for most of the 19th century, the price of ivory was around 11 shillings per kilogram. That's around 32 British pounds, 52 shillings today, or if you prefer, $42 or so. Volume. Ivory hunters wanted volume. Wagons full of ivory hacked off the dead heads of an elephant. A bloody business, but lucrative, and yet not as lucrative as feathers. Ostrich feathers are light, and these two-legged weird birds were still abundant within the colony, particularly in the arid and thinly settled west. They were much cheaper to hunt. All you needed was a horse and perhaps a mule to carry the feathers away, not forgetting a trusty musket and some powder. Ostrich feather production was a low-budget affair. The province of farmers and the rural underclass. The feathers were high value, averaging 10 British pounds per kilogram before the 1850s. Isn't it amazing to note that the feathers of this eccentric South African bird were worth 10 times more per kilogram than ivory? Wild ostrich hunting rapidly eclipsed elephant expeditions as the main target of commercial traders in the second half of the 19th century. There was such a demand that the feather price nearly doubled, dear listener, in the decade between 1855 and 1865, reaching 19 British pounds a kilogram in 1857. That was 20 times the value of ivory. Needless to say, this galvanized an assault on the wild birds by Eastern Cape farmers in particular, who began to consider domesticating the bird. The urban weekend warrior middle-class hunter of the Cape started campaigning for the protection of these birds. They had become addicted to the thrill of shooting something that couldn't shoot back. Not that I'm in any position to judge, having done my fair share of hunting over the years, but I digress. We'll return to the Struthio camelus, or the common ostrich, as zoologists call it, in coming episodes. This flightless bird was going to make many farmers incredibly rich through the 19th and into the 20th century. And ostrich domestication is actually one of the watershed moments in wild animal history of the Cape. Remarkably, ostriches used to be found across Africa, southwestern Asia, and the Arabian Peninsula, but they were hunted to extinction there. And just out of interest, ostriches were introduced into Australia, where their distant relative the emu lives. Hundreds of thousands of ostriches are now roaming the outback. They've gone feral after escaping from farms over the last 100 years. And like South Africans, Australians have been known to ride ostriches if you can hang on long enough. In South Africa, hunter sportsmen wanted the Cape government to protect a growing list of species that were being heavily hunted. Apart from the wild ostrich, the list included wild peacock or pau, the koran, namaqua partridge, quail, snipe, elephant, giraffe, hippo, buffalo, zebra, quagga, Burchell zebra, buck, which included the entire antelope species, gnu, hare, wildebeest. I'm afraid when it came to the quagga, time was running out. The last one was going to be shot in South Africa in 1878, and the last live quagga would die in an Amsterdam zoo on August 12, 1883. Speaking of Amsterdam, time to take a quick tour of the world and its events in 1860. The first Taranaki War broke out in New Zealand when Maoris refused to sell land to the British government at Wataara in North Island. That war would drag on for a year. Another island nation, Japan, was experiencing its own instability in March 1860. The Sakuradamon incident, where the chief minister of the Tokugawa shogunate, Lee Naosuke, was assassinated by a Ronin samurai outside the Sakurada gate of Edo Castle. Lee Naosuke had signed the 1858 Harris Treaty of Amity and Commerce with the United States, reopening Japan after more than 200 years of seclusion. Emperor Komei had ordered Naosuke not to sign the treaty, and thus the signing was viewed by the samurai as a betrayal of the emperor and, by extension, the country. From 1859, the ports of Nagasaki, Hakodate, and Yokohama opened for business, and foreign traders flowed in. The conservative samurai did not like that one little bit. So it was ironic that Lee Naosuke was shot in his carriage by a man armed with a Japanese-made Colt 1851 Navy revolver. Seriously wounded, Naosuke was dragged out of his vehicle by Ronin samurai Arimura Jisamon, who decapitated the injured shogun and then performed seppuku. Trade expansion around the globe was producing an array of social, political, and military issues that would go on to lead to a war between Russia and Japan by the turn of the century. Trade disputes often lead to wars. And from the ridiculous to the sublime. In April 1860, Frenchman Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville produced the world's first known sound recording of a human voice, the French folk song Au Clair de la Lune. To do this, he used his phono autograph. Not quite Dolby stereo, but keep in mind this was only 1860, for goodness sake. Just because history can be fun, the number one song on the Billboard Top 20 exactly 100 years later in 1960 was this. That, of course, is the theme from A Summer Place by Percy Faith. Ah, the instrumental that launched 1,000 Cinzano Spumantis. Finally, Giuseppe Garibaldi, Freemason and soon to be unifier of Italy, was on the move in July 1860, defeating royal Neapolitan forces near Messina and bringing nearly all of Sicily under his control. While Garibaldi was regarded as one of the heroic unifiers of Italy, his private life was chaotic. On the 24th of January, 1860, Garibaldi married 18-year-old Giuseppina Ramondi. Immediately after the wedding, she informed him that she was pregnant with another man's child, and Garibaldi left her on the same day. You can't make this up, you know. Garibaldi was a bit like Che Guevara, crisscrossing the world from battle to battle, venomously anti-slavery and anti-Catholic. Garibaldi was also an earlier supporter of the idea of a European federation. Some would say the spirit of Garibaldi is sorely required by Europe today as they face a real threat of war. A new European army is being considered as we speak. With that ominous comment, time to end this episode. Next, we'll swing across the countryside, perhaps taking in a few moments with the Trekboers and the New Republics to find out how the attempts at unification were going. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog and I'll load a few updates about various episodes. You can email me from there. Until next, Tootsies.